On Monday, September 21st, Justice Murray Sinclair spoke at the University of Winnipeg about the work and mandate of the Indian Residential Schools Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Justice Sinclair is the newly appointed chair of the commission. Sinclair was Manitoba's first Aboriginal judge, and in 1988 he was appointed as co-commissioner of Manitoba's Aboriginal Justice Inquiry. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission is funded entirely from money received by residential school survivors, from settlements with the Canadian government and religious institutions. In part one of this two-part recording, Justice Sinclair speaks about the history of residential schools and the Indian Act in Canada and their ongoing intergenerational legacy. In the second segment, he speaks about the work and mandate of the commission and what they hope to accomplish in their five-year term.
Question about this commission that I'm always faced with each time I talk to a crowd is where to begin. Imagine, if you can, for a moment, what it would be like if the government came and took away your children. Just like that. And they said, we were doing it because it's in the best interests of our country that your children be indoctrinated into the ways of our people. And that's what the government did with Aboriginal children in Canada beginning in the 1870s. They did it with the consent of the people. And for survivors and the children who were taken to those schools, that's probably the hardest thing for them to understand. It's a recurrent theme that we hear all the time. How could you let them do this to me? It's part of their stories, it's part of their questions, it's part of their need to find a way to reconcile with their ancestors and their parents and their relatives who they felt contributed to the situation that they were put into. Not all of them experienced abuse in the schools, we know that. And it is important that that message get out there. Not everybody who went to those schools was physically abused or sexually abused or psychologically abused, but they were all made to feel helpless. They were all made to feel afraid. And the one thing that has come out of the hearings that we have been able to conduct and the meetings that we have been attending since the beginning of our mandate in July of this year has been the constant refrain of fear that they talk about. The fear of being taken away from their family at such a young age and being left alone without the ability to talk to their mothers and their fathers, without the ability to be held by those that they love, and without the ability to see their brothers and their sisters and talk to them, and being told things about themselves that they didn't understand, about how bad it was to be an Indian person, about losing the language and having the language taken from them, about being punished if they took advantage of any opportunity they had to speak the language. And then as a child, if you are able in some way to get the message back to your parents, to tell them what it was that was going on and how you were afraid and how you wanted to leave and go home, imagine what your parents would have felt like. Imagine what you would feel like if you were a parent and you found out your child did not want to be where you had put him or her, and you wanted to do something about that. And you wanted to go and get them. And then you were told, no, you can't do that. It's against the law. Because the law was passed in the 1870s, which made it illegal for Indian parents to go and try to take their children out of these schools. A law was created that said that all Indian children between the ages of 5 and 17 have to attend schools designated by the Superintendent General of Indian Affairs. And while in this day and age we think nothing about the validity of compulsory education, we have to understand that compulsory education was not the norm in Canada until the Second World War. If you were not an Aboriginal person, you did not have to go to school by law until the Second World War or later. Compulsory education was not the norm in Canada, but it was for Indian kids beginning in the 1870s. And those children were taken and placed in those schools, and in many instances we know were never allowed to leave until they were old enough to leave, until they were 17, or until marriages had been arranged for them with people who had also gone to the schools. Because the common refrain we've heard was that they were told that they would not be allowed to leave just to go back to their communities and marry another pagan, that they were expected to marry a Christian so that they would raise their children to become Christians. Christianization of the children that were in those schools was an important part of the policy that was undertaken not just by the churches, but it was also one that was committed to by the government of Canada. Because the government of Canada believed fervently in the need to civilize the children in order to take the Indian out of them. It's a common statement that we heard and have seen more than once in the material that has been accumulated around the creation of these schools back in the 1870s. The idea was to drive the Indian out of the child and to take the children away from those who were able to influence the children in order that the ability to take that and do that with them could be complete. Now, one could think of that as a well-intentioned approach because, after all, the children were going to have to participate in society in the future, and there was no doubt that participating in society as it was at that time required a degree of knowledge, a degree of ability to deal with those things in society that were challenges. And our leaders, in fact, acknowledged that in the treaties, beginning with Treaty Number 1 that was signed here in this area, where education was a serious and significant component of their negotiations. They demanded that the government undertake to construct schools for their children because they wanted their children to get an education so that they could compete in society just like the non-Aboriginal children could. They wanted their children to succeed. They wanted their children to go and become professionals so that they could come back and advise them and their communities about how to deal with things that were going to happen, about the changes that were going to occur. And that undertaking by the government, that promise that was extracted by the people who were negotiating for the Indians at the time, was turned on its head. Instead of becoming a tool to strengthen the communities, it became a means by which the communities would be undermined at their most extreme way. We see lots of examples of how the individuals were impacted by the schools, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But the most significant impact that the schools had was upon the communities, because those who attended those schools came back and in many ways were unable to function within the communities that they returned to. They were unable to function because they were alienated from the cultures that they had left. They were unable to function because they were alienated from the people who had put them there. The alienation stemmed from the fact that they believed that they had been abandoned. They believed that they had been placed in these places that they did not want to be by people who supposedly loved them, and so their sense of love for that person was lost. And they believed that the communities that they were going back to were not able to provide them with an environment in which they could function properly as human beings. They did not know how to hunt and fish and trap and do those things that were necessary back in the communities they were raised in. So all of the skills that they needed as human beings were taken from them by that mere institutionalization. But the most important skill that they lost was the skill to interrelate to each other as human beings and the skill to raise children. If you are raised in an institution, I don't care who you are, if you are raised from the moment you are a little child until you are an adult in an institution, you do not learn how to take care of a home. You do not learn how to raise children. You do not learn how to be a parent. You do not learn how to be a partner. You do not see healthy relationships in those places. And that's the way that these people were raised from the time that they were little. And in many instances, as I have said, they were not allowed to leave to see their parents. They were not allowed to leave to go back home. They were not allowed to leave to return to visit. Sometimes their parents would be allowed to come and see them, but that was not always the case. And if you as a parent wanted to do something about that, you were faced with these laws that prevented you from doing that. You were faced with the pass system, which said that you can't leave your reserve unless you got a written pass from the Indian agent. And if you told the Indian agent you wanted to go to school and take your kid out, you would never get a pass. You were faced with a law that said that you couldn't go to court to challenge that law, which required your children to be in those schools because you had to get the permission of the government before you could sue them. You had to get the permission of the government before you could hire a lawyer. And if a lawyer agreed to represent you before you got permission from the government, then that lawyer would lose his license to practice law. And if you wanted to get friends of yours to sue on your behalf to go to court to challenge those laws, then those friends were prevented because the law was amended to say that nobody could go to court to challenge the government about these provisions unless they got permission from the minister. And there is no known instance of the government of Canada ever giving permission to be sued But in addition to that, if you wanted to protest, if you wanted to go out in public and carry signs, Indians are always demonstrating, right? It's a common practice, right? Yeah. Indians are always walking down Broadway with their signs. And it's strange because, you know, we couldn't do that for a long time. It was against the law. It was against the law for three or more Indians to get together in order to discuss a grievance against the government of Canada. You were committing an offense. Indian conspiracy laws were passed, which said that you couldn't do that. And then if you were back home and you wanted to pray for your children, you wanted to have a ceremony to pray for their health and their strength, you couldn't even do that because Indian ceremonies were made illegal in the 1880s. You couldn't go to a sweat lodge. You couldn't have a ceremony. You couldn't have a giveaway. You couldn't have a feast. You couldn't wear Indian garb, whatever that was. And it's interesting when I go to schools and share these stories and you see a pipe ceremony going on in the schools, or some elder will come in and talk about the drums and talk about the teachings and bring in the bundles and show the children the bundles. The children are shocked to learn that if their grandparents had been there and that had been done for them, then they would have gone to jail because it was illegal. And so while we acknowledge that most of the people who went to the schools were not physically abused, and were not sexually abused, and were not psychologically abused, although one could always argue what that term means, the reality is that they were all abused by the institution and by the system itself. The system was wrong. First and foremost, it was an issue of human rights. I always tell people that. This was not an issue about Aboriginal rights or loss of rights. This was an issue of the human rights of those children were taken away from them. And they were punished by being placed in an institution. And if you don't think that's a serious thing, then try being in an institution for a good period of your life. It's not very good. To be someplace, to be placed someplace where you don't want to be is bad. It's not good for you. It's not healthy for you. And when you come out, you are not a healthy person. And we know all of the things that happened back in the communities because of that unhealthy environment in which they were raised and the cycle of abuse and violence that instituted and continued today. And we know some of our communities are in chaos because of it. Our suicide rates are epidemic. Our health rates are poor. Our violence rates are high. Crime rates are high. Involvement in street gangs are very high. All of that we can trace back without any difficulty whatsoever to our residential school experience. But at the same time, we must keep in mind this very simple story that we heard at one of our survivor sessions, where a lady, an elderly lady, got up and she said, you know, she said, we must remember that we cannot continue to walk into our future backwards. We have to take responsibility for our future, she said. If we are going to be responsible for what goes on in the future, then we have to turn around and look into the future. We have to stop only walking while looking back. A very powerful image about where it is that we are at today. And that is this, that if we are going to allow the communities to heal from this, if we are going to allow the survivors to get past this, if we are going to allow the families to recover from this and become fully functioning individuals and families and members of society, then we have to look for ways to get past this. We have to look for ways to get this behind us. And that is why I think we have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission.